Welcome to this edition of Book Spectrum. I'm your host, Chris Gordani. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and keep an eye on our website, bookspectrum.com. You can also find this and past episodes on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Spotify, Spreaker, and other digital outlets. From the beginning of our existence, humans have contemplated our place in the world and in the universe. Whether we're here at random or a superior being created us, people have pondered those ideas. Religions developed over time to explain the unknown. We also saw the evolution of science. Over the centuries, there had been tension between religious leaders and scientists, developing into a full separation between many of the two camps. Today, scientists like Miku Kaku have come out and said science and the Bible are compatible and God exists. My guest on this book spectrum, Richard Crawland, is a mathematician, a logical and wide-ranging thinker by trade, with his book Enlightened in the 21st Century, says he has proven God exists through scientific fact. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you, Chris.
You say your book Enlightened in the 21st Century seeks to open the eyes of others to find both the truth in science and to find God. These days, there are a lot of people conditioned to believe science and religion are virtually mutually exclusive. What were your thoughts on this before embarking on this book, Richard?
Well, I know for a fact, after 60-some years of life, and I've always been a science junkie, and I've worked through these problems, and I present my case in the book, that there are no contradictions between science and religion. And once you see the book, you're going to agree with that. You're absolutely right. Teachers are teaching things, and they were probably taught things, and the parents of the students were probably taught things. So we have a lot of young people in school these days who are hearing things that just aren't true, and they've been accepted as common knowledge. And one of the purposes of the book is to dismantle some of those false ideas that are out there and that a lot of people think are true, but they're not true.
Well, the good thing is you break this down. You break down all your findings so there can be no smallest particle as how the cells know exactly what to do, that sort of thing. Without sounding preachy, that's important because some people tend to have an apprehension about believing in God, and I guess feeling like they're being preached to all the time is part of that.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I've been there. I mean, I went to Catholic schools as a child, and I'm old enough to remember when the masses were being said in Latin, and we would sit there in church because the nuns forced us to go, and there would be this stuff going on the altar, and we didn't even understand the language. If we swam too much or spoke or got out of line, we'd be in trouble. My early introduction to religion myself was pretty difficult and not very convincing. And in fact, the moment I got away from home to go to college, I just dropped all that stuff. And I had, for probably 10 years or more, I myself was walking around telling people that I was an atheist and I didn't see the need for God or any logical reason for us to conclude that he exists. But I've made that journey from an atheist to where I am today. And I know that others haven't made that journey yet, but I'm attempting to encourage them and to enlighten them so that once they know the truth, that path will be easier for them to find.
With me on Book Spectrum now is Enlightened in the 21st Century author Richard Crawland. I'm Chris Cordani, your host. I want to get into what we said about apprehension and atheism and people's kind of worrying about being preached to in just a few moments, but I do want to point out to our listeners that this book was not really planned to go public, just as Letters to Your Children.
That's exactly correct. As I was approaching the end of my work career, I had been a very successful person. I've had a very successful career. I've built a billion-dollar-plus company. And I did it because I, made good decisions and I treated other people properly. And I learned things through my life. And I've had some miraculous experiences from which I learned important things. And it really concerned me that I might pass away. My father died when he was 63. And when I was 62, I started to worry about taking this wisdom that I've acquired to the grave. And I decided I couldn't let that happen. So I started writing letters to my children. My children are now in their 30s. They're not kids anymore. But I wanted to make sure that they knew what I had learned. And that's how it began. As things developed, and I wrote more and more, and we finally pulled it together into the work that is this book. Actually, they were the ones that told me that, Dad, this is something that everybody would benefit from. And then that kind of planted the seed that maybe we should try to publish this. I sent it to the first publishing house, Christian Faith Publishing, and they accepted it for publication, which surprised me because I'd never written a book before. I've written thousands of letters to the editor, but nothing like this. But it was accepted, and it's being extremely well received, and hopefully everybody will read it.
One of the things I like about talking to new authors is, or first-time writers, as far as books are concerned, is how they got there. And this is really interesting because there are quite a few who just decided to write down a journal or maybe some thoughts that they want their children to read or maybe some of their relatives. This is another one of those books. Had you ever aspired to become a writer, or is this something that, again, you just didn't really think about before your kids came to you and said, this really has to be a book?
You know, that's a very interesting question because I have a reading disability. When I attempt to read a book, the muscles in my eyes jump around and I pick up words from the line or two above and line or two below. And I don't see that. I just think I'm reading across the line. And the way I know I've done it is because when I get to the end of the line, what I think I just read makes no sense at all. So I need to go back and I need to read each word very deliberately, very slowly to see what it actually said. So because I'm such a slow reader, and there have been many things where I've had to read, but I don't read for pleasure. I don't sit down and read books. It's just a slow and painful experience. When I was in college, I mean, I had this problem, you know, from the earliest part of my life. I majored in math primarily so that I wouldn't have to read books and I wouldn't have to write papers because it was just too time consuming and too laborious. So yeah, the fact that I wrote this book is something of a miracle to begin with because like I said, this is something I've really been kind of running and hiding from my whole life. And then when I sat down to do this, it just flowed. And as you referred to, I think it's a very readable book. It's in a very conversational style. There's not any technical scientific terms, even though I talk a lot about science. So it's come out quite well, but it's something of a miracle that I even tried to write it.
You wrote about some of your experience, Richard Growlin, the author of the book Enlightened in the 21st Century, with me on Book Spectrum, an intriguing tale. And again, because this book is really from a bunch of lessons you wanted your children to learn, your writings about them, one intriguing tale in the book is your encounter with a homeless person who was asking for money. What did you learn from meeting him?
Actually, he was involved in one of the turning points in my life. I actually came to be good friends with him. His name was Frank, but for years, I walked by him every day. He was a panhandler in downtown Pittsburgh where I worked. And, you know, I was in my 30s and early 40s at the time, and I didn't have money to give away. I mean, I had two small children, had a wife, had a budget. And I knew exactly how much money was coming in every month and exactly where we were going to spend it on. And I was not a giver. I mean, I felt I just didn't have any, you know, extra money to give. So I would walk by him every day. And then one day in my early 40s, I sat down to read the Gospel of Matthew. And the message I got out of those first 20 pages, again, I was probably at it for close to 3 hours. I only got through 20 pages because of the reading disability I have. But one of the messages that I got over and over again was, don't worry about yourself. Take care of other people, and God will take care of you. And for some reason, that message just really hit my heart. I mean, I believed it. I changed my mind about things. I changed my heart. I changed my behavior. And the next morning was a Thursday morning, and the day of the week is actually an important part of the story I relate in the book. But the next day was a Thursday morning when I passed him. I gave him a dollar for the first time after years of walking by. He always said good morning, even when I gave him nothing. But this day I gave him a dollar, and he said, thank you, you're welcome. I went on to work. The next morning I saw him again Friday. I gave him another dollar, thank you, you're welcome. On Monday, same thing. I mean, I was beginning to practice, you know, this thing that I had learned the previous Wednesday. And then I won't go into all the details now, but in the book, I relate things that happened to me that following week. Every day, something happened to me that had never happened before. It was all good. And finally, by Thursday of that week, I literally just stopped where I was standing. I looked up and I said, I get the message. I get the message, you know, God. And the message was that, you know, I was on the right track now. I mean, I didn't need to worry about myself. You know, things were going to be fine with me. I needed to keep doing what I could do to help other people. And that was literally a turning point. But he was the first person I ever, gave things to. I mean, just out of sort of the goodness of your heart. And obviously that practice has continued as the years gone by. And but really, that's, I don't know what the word reborn means as an evangelical Christian, but that's the experience that I had where, everything changed for me. And he was kind of a key person in that whole story.
Richard, you're a mathematician, a math professor, if you will. Tell our audience how you put together the relationship between math and God.
Well, math is perfect. You know what I mean? And the world is not. And God is perfect. So whenever you try to look at things through a mathematical lens, it's almost like having x-ray vision. I mean, and this has helped me in my business career because every problem has an abstract structure that's represented mathematically. And when you enter a situation and you know what the proper structure of the problem is, it really makes you very efficient in solving problems and gets you thinking. And Plato talked a lot about, perfection. It gets you thinking about what things really look like once you can get by all the confusion on the surface. That's kind of the nature of God, too. I mean, we're living in this physical world, and there's a lot of chaotic things that seem to be going on. But underneath it all, there really is a perfection. I mean, everything is made out of matter and energy. And as we learn from particle physics and from physics, when you get down, when these scientists get into looking at things at the atomic level and subatomic level, the universe is actually a perfect place. Every oxygen atom behaves like every other oxygen atom. It doesn't matter if it's in my lungs or on the space station or in a crater on Mars. I mean, oxygen is oxygen, it all behaves exactly the same. It's perfect. So I think having experience dealing with kind of the perfect underlying nature of things, which is the way math makes you think, that may have helped me to, see God's presence and to appreciate the fact that he really is there.
Of course, then you have the people that say, well, Adam wasn't supposed to eat that fruit from the tree of knowledge, and knowledge is bad. But you're saying knowledge and religion really should go hand in hand.
Well, if two things are true, they have to go hand in hand. I mean, if any two things really are true, then it makes no sense that they can't coexist. I mean, they must be able to coexist because they're both true and they both are coexisting. So as we learn more and more about science, scientific facts, I'm not talking about theories about, what the temperature is going to be 100 years from now or theories about something that happened 15 billion years ago. I'm talking about scientific facts. I'm talking about chemistry. Talking about physics. I'm talking about astronomy, what we've learned from our orbiting telescopes, what we can see and confirm every day. I'm talking about, we've mapped the human genome. I mean, we know every molecule now. That's something that's just happened in the last 25 years or so of the entire human DNA strand. The knowledge, the facts that we have now are true, and they've been demonstrated to be true, and they're accepted as true. So if that's true, and if God is true and God is real, then those two things have to harmonize. They have to, work together. They have to coexist. And as we get deeper and deeper into particle physics, my daughter happens to be a plasma physicist. She does experiments at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. It's the most powerful laser lab in the world. Every time they run an experiment, they're peering into nuclear fusion and what's happening at the subatomic level. And every experiment they do, they see things that no human being has ever seen before. So every day we're adding to our knowledge. And, so that knowledge is true and real. If God is true and real, then those two things should harmonize. And the theories and the apparent contradictions have to melt away if they're both true. And what I've learned over the years is that indeed, those contradictions do melt away when you take a look at the scientific knowledge that we have today that we didn't have 50 years ago. It's very clear to me. I don't use the word prove. I'm not saying that science proves God's existence. I prefer to use the word confirms, because what we're learning in science knocks down these contradictions. We can see those are no longer true. And everything that we do learn is consistent with God's existence. So I think of it as a confirmation process That's the way it's worked out. It might have worked out differently. I mean, if God wasn't real, we would be seeing things in science that, you know, can't coexist with God's presence. But the opposite is exactly true. We are learning things, and everything that we learn is consistent with the reality of God's existence.
Richard Kreltland is with me on Book Spectrum. I'm Chris Cordani. Richard is the author of Enlightened in the 21st Century. In the book, as we talked about, you use science and logic to prove that God exists. But we live in a time when people seem to be afraid of religion or God or talking about it. Now, I'm a to-each-his-own guy, and I believe most people are, live and let live. But we see it on social media. People get angry or fearful when someone adds the word God or a kind of religion or some kind of concept from there to a conversation. Again, we're a free nation. A lot of the world is kind of free. But how do we get here? How do we get to that point where people just get too angry when somebody mentions something that has to do with religion, even if there is a logical scientific point to it?
Yes, Chris, you're absolutely right. In fact, I'd love to talk about religion and science. I'd love to talk about politics. I'd love to talk about all the controversial issues. But religion is one of those topics where, you know, you can only take it so far with some people, and they do react badly. I mean, in my experience, I think everybody has their own reason for that. I'll give you one example. I have a very good friend, lifelong friend, who unfortunately his daughter passed away. She was born with something called Marfan syndrome. She had two or three open heart surgeries, and she eventually passed away before she was 2 years old. And it was just a devastating experience, as you might be able to imagine. But his name was Mark. In his case, his in-laws, his mother-in-law, father-in-law, and his wife were extremely religious. And Mark was not religious. Mark didn't believe in God, still doesn't. And during his daughter's illness, his in-laws were telling him that the reason she wasn't getting better was because he wasn't praying. Now, that's an outrageous thing to say. I'm sure they believed it. But that put a wall between him and anything that had to do with God. And I've been working on him for over 40 years, and he just can't get into the subject. You know, I mentioned when I was a small child, you know, to me and to my classmates, religion was not fun. I mean, religion was something that you had to do that make you go to church, that make you sit there, that make you behave when you're a little kid. You had no idea what was going up on the altar. The whole thing was just a mass of procedures and ceremonies that you didn't understand. And we all grew up with a pretty bad feeling about religion. And, you know, there's enough evidence these days scientifically, which is actually fake evidence. It's false evidence, which I discussed in the book. But there's a lot of reasons out there where people, you know, think that science has proven that God's not real, and they just don't want to think about it. You're right. They get angry. I don't understand that. Like I said, I love talking about it. I love thinking about it. But there are people out there that are very difficult to talk to. Let me just say one more thing about that. Everybody believes in science, I hope. But not everybody believes in God or religion. So that's why within my book, the approach I'm taking is to use scientific facts, just scientific data, things that are not controversial, things that scientists agree on, and use those to build up, you know, my case that there are no contradictions between God and science, and that, in fact, the science supports the existence of God.
Interestingly, we do have atheists around, and again, I'm a to-each-his-own person, and I do have friends who are atheists. I'm not going to insult them, but there are some among them who are people who think they're smarter than everybody else. But I'm going to put that aside, because not everybody's like that. But the idea is they just don't want to believe what they cannot prove exists, and that's a fair point. I believe your book does clear a lot of this up. On the other hand, they don't realize that atheism is also a religion by their own definition, because they blindly believe in their assertion but can't really prove that God does not exist.
Well, you know, I think it's very difficult for people, and I have very good friends, lifelong friends, that are also atheists. I was an atheist myself at one point, so I've made that journey back, and I'm trying to help other people to find that road back to God. But, you know, I think it's extremely difficult for anybody to believe in something that they can't comprehend. As an illustration, I don't know if you're a cat or a dog person, but if you've got a dog, you love your dog loves you, no matter how smart that dog is, and there's some really smart animals out there, that dog, you're never going to teach that dog, you know, geometry. And it just doesn't have the capacity to understand. Or if you have a cat, no matter how smart you think that cat is, you're never going to teach it calculus. I mean, they just don't have the mental capacity to understand geometry and calculus. Well, we have limitations also as human beings. It might be not fun to realize that, but we don't have the mental capacity necessary to comprehend the nature of someone or something who's capable of creating the universe or of designing all life on Earth or all life in the universe. I mean, that's so far beyond our ability to comprehend that you definitely cannot get your head around that. So I think that's a big obstacle for some people deciding to believe. I mean, it's just too much, and they just can't see it. Of course, if you think that way, if you can only believe in things that you understand, there's a lot of things out there that are real that you're never going to understand. So I think people need to get by that. But I do think that's a major roadblock to some people who just can't accept the existence of God. It's just something they can't understand.
Richard Crowland is my guest on Book Spectrum. His book is Enlightened in the 21st Century. What are your thoughts on a growing community of scientists who are saying religious stories and religious explanations, as well as the existence of God, are actually scientifically provable, or at least they go along with what science is studying and looking at right now?
No, I agree with that completely. In fact, I'm surrounded by scientists. My daughter is a plasma physicist doing experimental work in the most powerful laser lab in the world. I have a nephew who's responsible for the second phase booster rockets on the SpaceX missiles that have been resupplying the International Space Station. I have another nephew who's a PhD in biotechnology engineering out of MIT. He's working with human DNA to find new antiviral drugs. I have a son who's an electrical engineer. I have doctors in the family. I'm surrounded by scientists, and I'm a science junkie, so I talk to these guys all the time. And the message that I'm getting, just as you said, is just that. As we look more and more into the nature of the universe, I mean, how big it is, what we're seeing through our telescopes, how small it is, what we're seeing in particle physics and in DNA, the complexity of DNA, the functions of DNA, what we're actually learning in the way of scientific facts, really not disputed facts, it's just too much. It can't just be an accident. I mean, it's not an accident. The order, the design, and it's in the case of life. I mean, DNA is a very engineerable molecule. I mean, in fact, we're doing it. Scientists are doing it every day. These guys are taking segments of DNA and they're attaching it to viruses to keep them from multiplying and thereby discovering cures for viral infection. But the deeper you get into it and the more you learn and the more you appreciate the depth, the structure, the nature of it, I mean, there's just no explanation other than, you know, that this was created by an intelligent, I call it an overarching intelligence. This stuff could not possibly have happened by accident. It's too orderly. The laws of physics are being enforced every moment, every day, around the entire universe, and that just doesn't happen by accident.
If you look at creation stories among the vast religions, Richard, and I'm not even just talking about the Bible, you can look at the Quran, you can look at the ancient texts, you can look at the beginning of religion, people tried to explain life. They tried to explain things they didn't know through stories. But if you read the Bible and you look at the theory of evolution, we'll use that, or you look at how the earth was formed, yes, literal translation might say creation was zap, a god did this. But the fact is, if we did evolve in so many ways, perhaps these creation stories were allegory, if you will.
Yeah, I suspect they were. I mean, what's wonderful about these old, you know, these ancient stories, for example, the creation of the world, the creation of the universe, the people who were speaking them, you know, they were saying things that were understandable to themselves and to the people they were talking to. But they really didn't know what they were talking about. I mean, literally, when someone 2,000, 6,000, 10,000 years ago is talking about the creation of the universe, do they even know? They did not know what the universe consisted of. I mean, they weren't aware, as we are today, that there's, you know, over 2 trillion galaxies up there. They weren't aware how those galaxies were distributed and how they're moving. I mean, they literally did not know what they were talking about. I mean, that's just true. But they wanted to understand. They wanted to be comfortable. They wanted to feel secure in their situation and what was going on.
So, I mean, I understand that human curiosity and need to know sort of thing. But it's not until recently, and again, this is why the book title includes the phrase 21st century. It really isn't until the 21st century that we know what's out there. Let me just take that one example. Everybody's heard of the Hubble Space Telescope. We've probably seen pictures from there. If you haven't, you can, you know, go onto a search engine, put in Hubble Space Telescope, and you'll see hundreds or thousands of beautiful pictures that have been taken of the universe from above the Earth atmosphere, where we can get much clearer pictures. What most people don't know, though, is that mankind today, scientists, we actually have 80 orbiting telescopes up there right now. Of course, the United States has been putting them up. The Europeans, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Russians, even India has a few up there. I mean, there are now 80 orbiting telescopes. Some of them look at visible light, like the Hubble. Others look at infrared. Others look at ultraviolet. Others are looking at X-ray sources, gamma ray sources. So we're learning every day, you know, more and more facts about what's out there. And it's an infinite universe, so we're never going to stop looking. We're never going to stop learning. But all that information that we have today, we didn't have that 25 years ago. We certainly didn't have it 2,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago. So today, when we look at this, we know a lot more than those people knew. We have a lot more scientific facts than those people have. So the explanations we need to have today are things that are consistent with, you know, the facts as we know them. And because we know so much, because there's been such great advances, you know, we can draw much more reliable conclusions today. We still don't know everything, and I expect, you know, theories that we may draw up may prove to be wrong in the future as we learn more. But what's interesting to me is that with everything we've learned, and this is what I present, the possibility, the probability, whatever word you want to use, that this universe was created by God is actually, again, it's being confirmed by what we learned. It's not being disproven. It's being confirmed. And if you don't know what the most recent findings are, then that might be hard for you to accept. But those are the things I present in the book. I talk about what we now know that we didn't know before and how that supports the concept of, you know, the creation by an intelligent being, by God, of the universe.
Richard, people who are listening might want me to ask, what are some of these scientific facts you bring up in the book? But I say, it's in the book. Check it out. Enlightened in the 21st Century. We don't have hours for the show, but the book is a good read. I want to talk a little about you first. You do a lot of volunteer work, and you do sit on the board of Carson's Funds for Scholars. That's with, of course, our U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Ben Carson.
That's correct. The actual title is Carson Scholars Fund. If anybody would like to look that up, I'd encourage them to do so. Dr. Ben Carson is, I've shook the hands of presidents and things like that briefly, but Dr. Ben Carson is the greatest person, the greatest man I've ever had the opportunity to spend a lot of time with. His life story is, again, one miracle after another, and what he's accomplished in his life, given how he began, is just amazing. And he's made part of his life's work. Both Ben and his wife, Candy, began, I think it's about 20 years ago, this Carson Scholars Fund. And the purpose of the fund is to raise money to give academic scholarships to young people who are good scholars, like Ben was. Eventually, he actually started out as a terrible scholar, but he became quite good. He couldn't see. That's part of his story. When he was first few grades, he was the worst kid in the class academically. And then one day, somebody came to the school, gave everybody an eye test, realized he couldn't see, gave him glasses. And once he had his glasses on, he could read every word. And, you know, he obviously has blossomed. He eventually became a pediatric brain surgeon, currently serving as a housing and urban development secretary. But this guy has made part of his life's work, taking young people, mostly from, you know, economically challenged situations, who are very good academically. They've got the ability, and it's his mission to encourage them and to reward them and to let those people know that, let those young people know that, you know, they've got a real gift here, and it's important to use it. It's important to develop it. It's really one of the most worthwhile charities I can imagine, you know, helping young people use their God-given talents to do good things in the world. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a pleasure to work with him. And every time I'm with him, I'm just more and more impressed. He really is a great guy.
Richard, back to Enlightened in the 21st Century. What are a couple of the most important things you want your readers to learn or get most from it?
Yeah, I think there's two primary goals that I have for the book. For my friends and all those others who are atheists, who can't see the presence of God, can't see the reality of God, I'm sure that when you read this book, you will reconsider whether or not God is real. I mean, I think the scientific evidence clearly supports that. I make that case. And I'm hoping that I can reach those people, some of them are close friends of mine, to convince them that, you know, open your mind. Here's what the science shows. There are no contradictions. You know, let's rethink this. That's for the folks who don't believe in God. Of course, there are many, many people out there who do believe in God. There are people who are very faithful. They go to church services at least weekly. You know, they were raised in a religious tradition. They believe in God. They'll tell you they believe in God. But many of those people, even though they believe, they still don't see the presence of God in their everyday life. I mean, you know, they get up in the morning, they go through their day, they do what they have to do, they do what they want to do, but they're not seeing and feeling the fact that God is right there with them and can be relied on for help if you need them, and can be spoken to, communicated with. So I think people who have faith already, you know, they're going to get through the early part of the book, right, where I talk about the scientific evidence for God's existence. But then when I get into the later part of the book about, you know, I relate 9 miraculous experiences that have happened to me, things that changed my life, changed the course of my life, in some cases saved my life. Whenever I get into those stories, and by the way, I only included 9, just not to belabor the point. I could have put in 19 or 29 or 50. I mean, this kind of stuff happens to me all the time, honestly. But anyhow, the people who are faithful and they read those stories, I'm hoping to help confirm in their minds that not only is God real, but he's here, he's with us, he's available, and just to help them strengthen their relationship with God. Because once you have a relationship with God, I mean, really, that's when you can really achieve everything that you're capable of achieving. And if you're doing everything you can do, obviously you become a better person and you're making the world a better place. So that's what I'm going for. I'm trying to use truth and science to convince people of what's really going on here. And once they understand that, I expect them to be able to improve their lives and improve the world.
Richard Crawlin, thank you very much for being here with us on Book Spectrum.
Say my pleasure, Chris.
The book is titled Enlightened in the 21st Century. You can pick it up on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or other digital outlets. You can find more about Richard, the book, links to his site, and where you can get it on our website as well, bookspectrum.com. I'm Chris Cordeni. Thank you again for listening to Book Spectrum.